So we are finally into Nehemiah. So we've done Ezra, we've done Haggai, and now we're into Nehemiah. And because of that, I think that we need to do a little bit of a review. So I want to review, and I want to give us a nice, concise visual so that our review helps us, that we remember, so that, you know, next year, when you think, did I learn anything in Ezra and Nehemiah? You know, maybe there's a little spark of, oh, yeah, I just have to think of a heart and a brain and strong arms. So so here's what we have learned so far. So remember that we're working on the fact that when the Jews were in Babylon, when they were in captivity, they knew that they had to grapple with God in a stronger way. And so they really hung on to the Shema. Hear, O Israel, the Lord your God is one God, and you should love the Lord your God with all your heart and all your mind and all your strength. So they held on to that, and they had to learn what that meant, how to be aware of their heart and mind and strength, and how to engage them in loving God. So that's what we're talking about in Ezra, Haggai, and Nehemiah. So far we've talked about reviving the heart and renewing the mind. Once we get to Nehemiah, we're talking about restoring the strength. So reviving the heart, I'm only going to give you 2 points for each so that it should be very easy. Reviving the heart, this is always about taking in. So the first one is always about taking in. So to recognize, usually. So in reviving the heart, we want to recognize the gifts of his presence. So we're talking about rebuilding our identity, right? Which is what the Jews had to do. They kind of lost their identity when they went into captivity. We lose our identity. We don't think about it, and we take on other identities. We want to rebuild that. That our identity is God's dwelling place. We are his image bearers. We are where he dwells. In order to revive our heart as God's dwelling place, we need to recognize the gifts of his presence. And we talked about 3 gifts. Does anybody remember the 3 gifts that we should recognize? Don't read it. I want you to really think. The hope of restoration, which whenever we talk about the word hope in Scripture, it always means assurance. The assurance that everything he's doing is restoration, which is why I have my pig, which is why some of you have different things. That we should remember that it's a gift, that everything he's doing in your life is restoring. He's offering restoration. Every single thing. So it's really, for me, it's really helpful to have my little pig around. Because I walk past it in the midst of being upset or hurried or anxious or joyful. And I walk past and I say, this too is restoration. This too is restoration. So recognizing that everything is restoration, is God's invitation to restoration. So that was recognizing that gift, the restoration. Anybody remember the second gift?
Work.
That's the third gift. Yep. Well, let's say worship.
I thought worship was the third one.
Worship is the third, and we're going to talk about work as worship down here. But the second one?
Community.
Yeah, community. So, the way we revive our hearts is, first of all, to take in the gifts. Recognize that he's always restoring us, that he's using community to do so, and that's also where he's restoring us to, community. And thirdly, that he's giving us the gift of worship. And that is that we get to be in his, we get to have an audience with the king. That's a gift. And I'm sad that we are not a monarchy in the United States, only because there's so much flavor in Scripture about kingship and recognizing the awe of being in the king's presence. We just don't have that, right? Mm-hmm. Awe in the United States, awe is just, it's a nonentity. We don't really understand what awe is. But if you could pull yourself back, thinking about being in a society that had kings, and you being called into the king's presence, I mean, that's like, that's awe. And we can say maybe President Obama would invite you in, and there might be a smidgen of awe, although I don't think it'd be a great deal.
No.
There wouldn't be this, I'm getting to come into the presence of you.
Because we change them too often.
Right?
Well,
you know, well, that's not respect. Queen is usually in, you know, in power for
yeah.
their lifetime.
Right.
Yeah. Right through their line. So.
Yeah. And the Pope, there's a little bit of that.
Yes.
Pope,
yeah.
Certainly.
Right. Right. So those are the gifts. We need, so in reviving our hearts, recognizing the gifts of His presence, the hope of restoration, community, and worship. And to reorient then our heart, to center our heart around the fact that work, and when I say work, I mean anything you do, whether you're getting paid for it or not, whether you're cleaning up in your home and taking care of your children, whether you're taking care of kids, whether you're having coffee, whatever you're doing, that's what I mean by work, is worship. And if it's not worship, if it is not a physical manifestation of your submission to God, then what is it?
Idolatry.
Idolatry. There aren't any other choices. So reviving our hearts to reorient ourselves around the fact that work is worship. That everything we do is worship. So that's all you need to remember about reviving your heart. Recognize the gifts and reorient your heart around work as worship. Renewing the mind. What we need to recognize here, we need to recognize Eden and East of Eden. What do I mean by that?
Kind of when it's
God's presence growing up.
Or like you're choosing your will, or you're choosing like to believe that what God has for you is good.
Okay, good. And what's in Eden as opposed to what's in East of Eden?
God's presence.
God's presence.
No.
The garden.
Yeah, and what about the garden?
Life.
How about abundance versus
scarcity.
So we renewing our minds, and I think this is one of those big ones, is you're choosing where to live and where to work. You're choosing whether you're living in Eden, where there's abundance, and you have more than enough for everything, or whether you're choosing to live east of Eden, outside of His presence, where there's scarcity. And you always know where you're living the minute you hear yourself say, what? I don't have enough. I don't have enough. I don't have enough. You hear yourself saying that, and it should be this red flag. Whoa, where am I living? I'm living east of Eden. Because east of Eden will always be a place of scarcity. I don't have enough. I'm not enough. Whatever I have is not enough. So renewing the mind, recognizing whether you're living in the place of abundance or the place of scarcity. And receiving, so always this is a breathing in and a breathing out. A breathing in and a breathing out. Breathing in, taking in a new way of your heart seeing things, a new way of your mind seeing things, and then doing something about it, basically. Engaging the heart, engaging the mind. And this is receiving fasting. And when I mean by that is receiving fasting, a contracting of yourself, actually doing that, contract yourself, receiving that. Because if the whole point of rebuilding my identity is God's dwelling place, and I never contract myself, what am I doing then? I'm saying I don't want to be God's dwelling place, right? Contracting yourself, fasting, means giving God space. Receive that. Fasting is not, we tend to look at fasting, first of all, very narrowly, and as if it is an obligation and a duty to do something, rather than this huge, amazing thing that we can do, that we can contract ourselves and allow God to have more presence in our life, which is what the feet were about, letting him walk around, right? Actually, we'll talk about that in the cultivating. So renewing, reviving your heart is recognizing the gifts and to reorient your life around work as worship. Renewing your mind means to recognize the whether you're living in abundance or scarcity, God's presence, or on your own, and receiving fasting, receiving the contracting of yourself so God is present. In all of that, and including in the strength, we need to always be cultivating. And cultivating means I'm out in the garden and I'm trying to get rid of any of the impediments for growth, right? So if there's, you know, we don't live in a place that's rocky, but my mother-in-law grew up in Germany, and she grew up on a farm, and she would tell stories about how she hated it because she'd have to go out, and her job all day long would be to go find rocks that are sitting in the garden. There's a lot of places that you actually have to get rid of the rocks all the time, and it's not a one-time thing, right? They keep coming up. They literally keep coming up. And so they have to get rid of them. So cultivating the heart, the mind, and strength means, am I allowing God to show me in my heart, in my mind, in my strength, places where there are impediments to his presence? And we call that sin. But I think it's really helpful if we call them impediments to his presence, places where he can't be. We had the books stacked up here, right? And he knocks on them and says, hey, I can't get over this. Do you want to bring it down? And so we talk about three things about when we cultivate and what we do about sin or impediments. We first mourn those impediments. And by mourning, we mean we realize that we don't want him in certain places of our lives, because we really don't believe he's a good father. We really don't believe he's going to give us what we think would be good for us. And that's what we mourn that. Because, I mean, we mourn knowing the truth in our head, but not in our hearts. That he's not a good father. We confess and say, I agree with God. God says sin is rejecting the gift of my presence. Sin is rejecting the gift of my presence. I agree with you, God. That is exactly what I have done here. So any sin that you come up against, that God points out to you, mourning it as, that's a place I don't think God is good. And what happens when I even say that? All of a sudden it comes to light, right? Really? Do I not believe God is good? No, I do believe God is good. And confessing, yep, that is a place where I refuse to have his presence. And then the last one is repent. And when we talk about repent, remember it's always metanoia, which is change your mind. There is, and this is always going back to the story of Cain. Change your mind, Cain. There's a place you can go with this. This is not the end of the story. You don't have to just keep in your sin, which is what he did. God says, look up. Just look up. There's a place you can actually go to get restoration for this. You can come back into his presence. There's never a time where God says, sorry, you can't come back in my presence anymore. So that when you reject his presence, when you don't think he's good, repent. Change your mind. There's a place you can go. Oh, I can go back into his presence still. So that's pretty much the overview of what we've done so far.
I mean, I'm trying to think about all this. Like, is it really, like, I can go back into his presence? Or is it about, like, the impediment? Right? So, like, his presence can go here.
Right.
I don't know. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
Like, I'm trying to think about
it. Yeah.
Like, making my head.
Yeah, and you're right. That's, and of course, all of these are the way we use language. But it's both, really, right?
Okay.
It's, I can go into his presence. Really, what he's saying is, you don't have to turn, when he's knocking, you don't have to stay closed up. You can say, oh, yeah, you can come in. You can walk around in here. It's not a closed door. It's not a nailed shut door.
Yeah.
It's a door that you have the handle to, right, that you can actually open.
Yeah.
So does that help with the review? We'll kind of go back to that. I did actually think about, you know, long ago, and Karen's probably the only one in here that, I mean, long ago when we used to teach, what did I used to do at the end of class? At the end of the very end of all of the...
A test.
Yeah, we used to do a test. How could you forget the test?
Like page after page.
Yeah. Yeah, real test. Real test. Yeah. It was a great review. I mean, you literally had to study for it, and we did have, at one point, somebody actually call in and do the test. Do you remember that? She couldn't be here, but she called in on conference call and did the test with us.
There are too many of the test anxieties.
Yes, right, and that's what I found. Okay. But this is what, the review is so helpful. So I did think, I should bring back the test. No, I'm not going to do that. No, I won't do that. But understand where my heart is. My heart is that it's so easy to just take this in as information. And I'm just always struggling to find ways to make sure that it's not just information. I can't force your heart to change. Only God can. But I am trying to like push you to give him the permission to change your heart. And not just have this head full of stuff where you walk around like one of those, you know, large head people, you know, that are kind of like walking around. No good for anything.
Bobbleheads,
yeah. So hopefully that will help. But we'll probably revisit that and kind of and fill in restoring the strength. So we'll have two more points then for restoring the strength through these next last couple lessons. So, to Nehemiah, we start out Nehemiah, knowing that Nehemiah begins with, the remnant who survived the captivity is in distress and reproach, and the wall of Jerusalem is broken down, and the gates are burned with fire. So, let's bring us up to speed, and let's remember what has happened in Ezra and Haggai up to this point in Nehemiah. So we know that they were in exile, right? They were exiled in Babylon / Persia. Same area, just renamed, and the capital moved from Babylon to Susa to Ecbatana, I think. So the capital moved around, but that's they were in the same section there. They got to come back, right? Because Cyrus issued a decree, because God had moved his heart, they got to come back. In 536, to rebuild the temple. They rebuilt it for about 2 years, and then they stopped. Do you remember why? Opposition, right? There was opposition. The people who were back there, mostly Samaritans, did not want them to build the temple. So they stopped for 14 years, and it laid fallow. And between the time that they stopped building the temple and the time that Haggai comes onto the scene, what have they been doing for 14 years?
Building
their own homes. Oh, we forgot to say the
luxury.
Verse. Yeah. Why are you living in luxurious homes?
In my house.
So that's what that's what happened in those 14 years. Is they're building their houses, trying really hard to get enough, right? But how does it work? They never get enough, right? They never get enough. And so Haggai comes on the scene and lets them know, remember that abundance is living in his presence, and you're living outside of his presence. You're trying to make your own life, build up your own life. It's not going to work. You're never going to have enough there, ever. I promised you that in Genesis 3, that you will always toil and be unproductive in your work as long as it's outside of Eden. So they restart. And here's the interesting thing about Haggai. Haggai is super short, and unlike almost all the other prophets, his language is very curt and very short. Most of the prophets have very flowery language. They have a lot of metaphors. Haggai is right there. And the reason is because of the year it is. So Haggai comes on the scene at 520. And remember that the temple was destroyed in 586. So this is the whole reason for a guy, the two chapters that are super short and right to the point. What Haggai knows, they've only got 4 years before it's 70 years since the temple's been destroyed. They've got to get this temple built. Because God's prophecy said they will be in exile for 70 years. And the 70 years actually is the count from the temple destruction to the temple rebuilt. And therefore, the whole point of him being short and to the point is, you got to do this now, right now. And unlike all the other prophets, Haggai actually gets them to do it within a month of his prophecy. They start rebuilding. And they rebuild it, and it takes them 4 years, and they finish it off at the 70-year mark. So there's the 70 years that you have there. So they have the temple rebuilt. They have the temple services going on, and that's going on. Somewhere between then and Artaxerxes, who we're going to talk about in a minute, the king that's in Nehemiah, somewhere in between there, they also start building the wall and repopulating the city. But something happens, and they get opposition again. And the opposition does not want them to build. And we know this because in Ezra, we have this later on during the thing of during the time of Artaxerxes, we wrote a letter to Artaxerxes, the enemies, and said, they're being rebellious. You should know about Jerusalem. Jerusalem's always been a rebellious city, and they're trying to build up the city again. You've got to stop them. And so Artaxerxes is the one who stops them from building up the wall and the cities in Jerusalem. So that's happened after the temple was built. The wall and the city are not being rebuilt now. So there's two or three kings in between Artaxerxes, and nothing is happening with the city and the walls. What actually probably is happening is, since there are no walls, people don't feel safe. It would be very difficult to live in a place where you have been brought back in and there are no walls. So not only are people not repopulating Jerusalem, they're moving out of Jerusalem. So although the temple is continuing on and the services are continuing on, most of the people have left Jerusalem.
But where have they gone? Because how many other walls are there? Like
they're mixing in with the people all around. So they're living in Judah, mixing in with all the people. They've already built their luxurious houses, right? And they're mixing in, which is why Ezra comes on the scene and says, I need to go back and teach them, right? So Ezra comes about the sixth year of Artaxerxes' reign. He comes and starts teaching the people. And they come to Jerusalem to hear, and they hear that. And that's when we talked last week about the covenant with the foreign wives. So he teaches them that. But they go back into their homes. In fact, remember it says, we're so spread out, it says. We can't do this in 3 days. Mm-hmm. Let's do this, you know, little by little. We'll go to each town and each town's. So that's why they're all spread out. Now, yes, all Judah was supposed to be repopulated, but this is really important that Jerusalem be repopulated, and it's not. So this is where we come up to, is Nehemiah has a brother who went back in that. Remember, there's been two times that people have come back, once with Zerubbabel and once with Ezra. They came back. One of those people that come back was Nehemiah's brother. And he's come back to Susa, and Nehemiah is asking him, so how is it there? And he says, the people are in distress, and they're in reproach, because the cities, the walls are broken down, and the gates are burned. They're not living there, and they're in a bad place. So we need to understand the word distress is actually the word for evil, ra, and that word actually means of inferior quality. So when he says they're in distress, he says they're living in an inferior way, in a way that they shouldn't be, because they actually could be living in God's presence, and they're not. They're living in a way that's inferior. So that's the word, ra, distress. So it's not like, oh, it's horrible. It's, no, this is devastating. They are not living with God's presence. Reproach is dishonor, disgrace. So, yes, they're disgraced. They're shamed. For they're the people of God, and they've said that God's presence is like the big thing, and they're not living like it. In fact, the word disgrace also has the connotation of pointing fingers. So it's, they're blaming everybody else for them not living there.
Is this while they're building their luxurious houses?
This is beyond that. This is where they've left Jerusalem. So the temple was built, right?
Okay, yeah.
So they built the luxurious houses, then the temple got built.
Okay.
Now it's this time of, we don't know how to live. We've got enemies that tore down the walls, and we don't want to be there anymore, so we're going to leave. But that's disgraceful. And they're beginning to point fingers at not just the people who burn it down, but at one another. Well, you didn't do your job, or you didn't do your job, or whatever. This part of disgrace, that happens, right? When we're disgraced, we want to defend.
Yeah.
And so they begin to point fingers at one another, complaining about the fact that they're not in Jerusalem, that they don't have the walls built, that the city isn't being populated, but not doing anything about it. That's the situation we're at in Nehemiah. So, we need to talk then about gates and walls, exactly what they are, what they do, and what they're really representing here for the people and then for us. Walls have a couple purposes for cities during that time. First of all, is they defend that city as a legitimate power. In other words, they say, we actually have some legitimacy here about being able to rule. It signifies a place that's able to rule themselves, that they're powerful and able to conduct life for their own residents. In fact, when you have a walled city, it says we are strong enough not only for our own residents, but maybe if anybody else wants to come in. We'll talk about that in a minute. But it is definitely a defense saying we are a power. Secondly, it protects from corruption or distortion so that the kind of life the city has doesn't get distorted from outside influences. So if a city has a wall and it has its own power, its self-rule, and the wall is broken down, people can come in and be infiltrate what's going on and decide maybe other different ways to live a life. Does that make sense? There can be influences from the outside world that kind of make chaos of the city. And influence from the outside could eventually topple the kind of life that's being protected here. So that's not good. So you need something to protect that. In that it protects a self-rule place, it also provides a place for flourishing. Because if it's a place that has walls that's protected from the outside, I can actually go about my day-to-day life without worrying always about someone coming to attack me, right? That's why we love to hear that Naperville is, you know, one of the safest cities for children to grow up in, right? We like that because it means we can focus our attention on other things. I mean, why don't people want to move into Dixmoor or, you know, into some of the inner city parts? Why wouldn't you want to go move there? Why wouldn't you want to go move into some of your projects?
Shot.
Yeah. And why would that be such a big deal?
Yeah, right.
It's hard to raise your children if you're shot.
It's unsafe.
It's unsafe. And if it's unsafe, if I'm always feeling unsafe, how do I live? I'm always living defensively. I'm always looking at everybody and everything as a potential harm to me. So do you understand the importance of being able to feel safe so that you can flourish? I don't flourish. No one flourishes in a place that they don't feel safe. So a wall is really important for these towns. Now, obviously, we don't have walls here. We have different things. We have laws, right? Our walls are laws, and we're going to talk about the difference between the law that we have and the law that God has. But a wall is important. It establishes a place that is legitimate, is a power, is a place that could be a good place to live. It protects from that life that they have set up in that city from being corrupted. And it also gives you a place to flourish. So walls are important. But, and this, every time I've ever heard anybody talk about Nehemiah, they only talk about the walls. Here's the interesting thing. If you start counting, like I ask you to do, when you do keywords, and you count wall, and then you count gates, which do you think has more? Gates has more. There are 10 gates in this city. And when you look, I forgot to bring my computer on. When you look at the size of the city of Jerusalem, the fact that it has 10 gates, it's crazy. It's really crazy. When you were building a medieval city, and if any of you have been to walled cities in Europe, how many gates do they usually have?
One.
Well, they usually have two, back and front. But the more gates you have, the more vulnerable you are, right? Isn't it interesting that Nehemiah wants to build this city with 10 gates? That's really interesting.
There's supposed to be 12.
There are supposed to be 12. There are 10 only in this. And there's a couple reasons for it. So gates, first of all, are important for the city that Nehemiah is building because they invite participation in life. So this city is not a city walled off from people. It is a city inviting people into a safe place, inviting people into a place that they can flourish. Their open gates allow anybody to come on in and sample the life inside, experience what it is to live there, relate with the people that live there. And if you've been to Jerusalem, you will understand that some of these gates are huge. You can drive cars through them. So you can drive your car in through one of the main gates there. Some of the gates are medium size, where you could drive a small car through. And some of the gates are only for walking through. All different size gates. But they are open so that people can come in and sample that life and see what it's like to live in this place. Gates also, at this time, were a place to regulate order, because they were the courts of law for the residents. So the gates, remember when they talk about the men sitting in the city gates? Mm-hmm. Those are the places of judgment. Those were the courts. And that's where you help the residents inside to come together and live together in an orderly and peaceful way. So it helped, so there is a way to get the peace inside of the city as well. And that's what a gate would have done as well. So not only do they invite participation into the city, and not only do they help the city maintain an orderly peace, but they also allow the residents to go out. The residents don't have to stay in the city. They can go out. They have this great thing, and they aren't supposed to keep it to themselves. So that they have, there is an invitation to invite. There is the ability to go out and look for people who might need what they have, and to minister outside, and to, they are, so here's the unusual thing about this city. This city is actually built for the purpose of going out to help anybody else. So it's not primarily for people to come in on their own. It's primarily for them to go out. They have a place that they can flourish and feel safe. Mm-hmm. So let's share it with everybody. And so that they can go out.
I guess I'm so confused because I just felt like the Jewish culture was more about it's only for Jewish people, not necessarily for anyone outside of that. Now, are you saying they're inviting the Jewish people to come in, or you're saying they're inviting anyone around to come in?
Okay, that's the ideal.
Okay.
You're right. They don't do that.
Okay.
And in fact, this becomes a point where they actually start closing in.
Okay.
So in history, this is a point where they really just tighten in. Because remember, this is toward the end of the Old Testament as we have it. And then we have Jesus come on the scene and all the new types of stuff, and we realize, wow, they are really a closed society, right? Mm-hmm. But remember, from this point on, they never rule themselves again. Until 1948. Mm-hmm. So So yes, but the intention is, remember God said, you are my model. Mm-hmm. And what does Jesus do with the new 12 tribes that he makes in his disciples? What's the first thing he says? Go out, right? Go out. So that was the intention, which they never did. But you understand the importance of the gates in the wall, right? Does that make sense?
The gates also keep people out.
They do keep people out. And we'll talk about that as we go in, because so all of Nehemiah then is going to be talking about the walls and the gates.
But do they have to guard the gates? Because that doesn't seem very safe.
Yeah. Well, and the gates close.
Like they close them. Yeah.
The gates close at night. And they close at different times. So
they also were where they defend. I mean, that you come in the gate and you make a right turn.
Yep.
And go out so that their people can shoot at you and throw a box on you.
And that's part of the...
so they're part of the defense.
They are part of the defense. But remembering that this defense is very different than what we're thinking about. Both the wall and the gate are integral to the city's health. You can't, from what Scripture is talking about, and the kind of city that God wants built is, you cannot build a wall without gates. And you can't have gates without a wall. So you need both, and they're never separate. So when we talk about the walls and the gates, we're really talking about truth and grace of God, and we'll get into that a little bit more. But the truth and the grace are not separate entities. They are one and the same. They have got to be together. So, strong, intact walls and gates are essential to keeping the city intact as a place of God's presence. Remember that if they are a place that's defending something, they are defending the presence of God. And they are defending the presence of God as he gave it to us. So they are trying to keep intact the integrity of God's presence. Not only are they trying to keep it intact as he's given it to us, but as a place where people can come and be and live, which is why they need both the walls and the doors. Does that make sense? We've got to keep God's presence intact the way he's given it to us, not how we decide or not how any outsider decides, but how he's given it to us. So the temple is there, but then the wall is around it to make sure that his presence is always available as it was given. It means that the experience of being in his presence isn't mixed with any East of Eden type of things. They're able to offer God's presence as it is given, as it was given in all its fullness, so that we are called not to let anyone miss the grace of God. That's part of his presence. We cannot offer God in only his instructions, because then people miss the grace, and that's not his fullness. So the point of the walls and the gates is to make sure that we keep his presence intact, and we keep the integrity of what he has given us in his presence intact. We don't want his presence, how he's revealed himself to us, to be obscured by any world paradigms. Some of the world paradigms are God needs to be appeased. We don't want anyone ever to think that God needs to be appeased, because that's not how he's told us. He's not revealed himself as a God who needs to be appeased. He's not revealed himself as a God who is angry first. He's revealed himself as a God who creates and is vulnerable and wants to be with us. So we've got to keep that intact, which is our walls and our gates. He's not a God who doesn't know what is best for the world. We must keep that intact. We cannot present a God who is wishy-washy, who says, well, you know, I'm not sure what's good for you guys. Maybe you guys can decide. He knows, and he's told us what is good for you. In fact, what does Micah 6:8 says? I have told you, man, what is good for you. That is to do justice and to love kindness, hesed, and to walk humbly with your God. I know what is good for you to become who you were meant to be, who you were created to be. I know that. And we can't present him any differently. So keeping intact the integrity of God's presence is really, really important. So I have a couple visuals for you to understand that. So I have a baseball here, and I know you can't see this, but the baseball is actually signed by Mickey Mantle. Anybody, does anyone know who Mickey Mantle is? Oh, okay. So I was a newspaper reporter and editor for a while, and I was in my early 20s. The sports writer for our newspaper, today it would be called sexual harassment. I didn't know any better. I didn't know anything. So Mickey Mantle was coming to the newspaper, and he wanted to get a ball signed for me. I mean, he knew I was a big baseball. I played baseball, and so, you know, he thought that would be great. I was at the time, I think I was engaged to Bill. I'm trying to think about this. I was 21. I think I was engaged. Yeah. And he did not like that, the sports editor. And he did all sorts of things. But one of the things he did, he wanted to get this ball signed for me. So when Mickey Mantle came, he had Mickey Mantle sign this ball for me. And it said, to Jill and he gave him the wrong name. He didn't give it Bill's name. He gave another name.
His name?
Huh. It wasn't his name. It was just, in other words, I don't like the fact that you're engaged. I don't like this, so I'm going to give this. So I get the ball back, and it says to, I wish I could remember the name. You can hardly see this writing. To somebody and Jill. Best wishes, Mickey Mantle. And I saw that, and the first thing I thought was, oh my gosh, if Bill sees this. Remember, I'm 21. Very much more immature than the younger people here. I was just freaking out. I can't let Bill see this. So what do you think I did? I erased the name. I erased the name, and I put Bill's name in there. So, and here's the funny thing. If you look out, I'll pass it around so you can see it. The only thing that really has stayed, because I never even protected it, is the bill. So now, what did I do to the integrity of the ball?
Yeah, you destroyed the value of it.
I just destroyed the value.
Yeah. Because that's not his writing. It's
because true. I was afraid, right? I was afraid. And so I destroyed the value. I ruined the integrity of it. It is no longer a full thing. I don't think this would be worth, somebody said it would be worth something because Mickey Mantle is still there, although you can't, because I never protected it, because once I destroyed it, to me it was nothing. So I'll pass it around, you can see that. That's what we do with God when we don't present him in his fullness as he's presented himself. Not how we want to present him, but how he's presented himself. So in all his glory of his grace and his truth, both, we destroy the integrity and we lessen his worth in the view of other people and in his eyes as well. Now I have another thing that I was given. So I have this, I'm not even sure what it's called. This was sent to me her name is Mama Rita, that's what we call her. This was sent to me by the woman, by the family, who took Lissa in Syria and became her surrogate parents. She lived next door to them, and they are Iraqis who were, because they're Christians, they were thrown out into Syria. So they lived in Syria next to Lissa, and she Mama Rita and Papa Rita took Lissa in as their daughter. Now, they had three daughters. One of them was gone, and they just loved her, and they sent this to me. Now, I want you to think about this. They were refugees. They were brought to Syria. How much do you think they had?
Not
nothing. nothing. And they send this to me. Now, what do you think I did with it?
Put it in your closet.
Put it in a drawer.
I folded it up right away and I put it in my closet. Why?
Because it's not something you would wear here.
And why not?
It doesn't fit in.
Yeah, it doesn't fit in, right? It doesn't fit in my culture at all. So I thought, wow, isn't that nice? And I put it in.
I thought you'd put it in to save it because it was so.
Yeah, I'm not that nice.
Gorgeous.
You should have worn it today.
Well,
it's a great color.
I did think about, okay, you know, I could, what else could I use it for? Right?
Yeah.
I could think of another way to use it.
Tablecloth.
Okay. So I could do that. I could use it for some other purpose. Which still is taking away the integrity of the gift, right? So I did think, well, how could I do that? I know what I could do. I could actually.
No!
No!
Why not?
I knew she was going to do that.
Well, but now, see now what I can do? Now I could sew it. See,
oh,
that's short enough.
I see what you're doing.
Oh,
there.
It's an angle. There we go.
You wore tights under it.
And I could sew it to maybe a little form fitting, and maybe it'll fit in. Maybe I could do that.
With jeans.
You're changing it.
Yeah. But what did I do?
Change it.
I did. I changed it. Why? Why?
To meet your needs.
Yeah. To fit in, right?
Mm-hmm.
To make it fit into my culture. But what did I just do to... Okay, Mickey Mantle probably could care less that I ruined his ball. But Mama Rita?
Don't show it to her.
What did I just do?
You didn't appreciate her gift.
Mm-hmm. I didn't appreciate the gift. I didn't take it as it was, right? And I really said, you know, you're not quite as important as me fitting in my culture, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, and I'm just being honest with you, I would never have worn it. Will I wear it now? I'm actually thinking about literally bringing it in because there are some of this coming out now, a little different. So I'm thinking about that. Now, I did think about this long and hard. Should I cut this off to make a point? Yeah, and you're in pain, right. But you'll remember it, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because that's what we do with God all the time. We are always changing what he's told us so that we fit into the culture. So that we don't stand out.
Or to what our heart says.
Or whatever. And it's not always with law, but it's a lot of times with grace that we change it, right? We would rather still do the transactional culture thing rather than the grace thing. I want us to understand how serious it is when they leave Jerusalem and they leave the walls, just crumble down, and they just start living... The temple's still going, and they're still going to the temple, and they're still saying, oh, you know, we love God, and we want to worship him, and we want to be in his presence. Building the temple took their hearts and their minds. The problem is, the hearts and the minds are something that can kind of be kept private, right? I can worship God, and it can be just me and God, which is such a fallacy. Because there is no such thing. Remember, we know cohort. There is no such thing as just me and God. But I can do it with all of you guys. And that would be fine. But coming in and out of the temple, you know, that's fine. I can do that. That can kind of stay private. In reality, it can't, right? If I'm really engaging my heart and my mind in centering around God, then it does come out in my actions, my strengths as well. But I at least can live that fantasy. That it can be private. The problem with strengths, the problem with walls and gates, is it's very public. It is an out there, this is what God says, this is who God is. He is truth and grace, and the two cannot be separated. The world will let me have my religion. No problem. As long as I don't make it out to be a kingdom. As long as I don't make it out to be an exclusive place where we can find life. The world is fine with me having that. As long as I don't start building walls that say, no, 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 this is a legitimate power for everybody. That's when it gets a little sticky, right? That's when people don't like to hear that there's one God and one way to have a life that is fulfilling and bringing us to wholeness. This is why, so in Nehemiah 1, we have two enemies come, and one of them is named Sanballat. And Sanballat comes, and he's very upset about Nehemiah wanting to build the wall again, because Sanballat is the governor of Samaria, and Samaria is the center of power right now. It's where the government is for all of Judah. If Jerusalem, the city, gets built with the walls, he knows that it will topple Samaria. So just like us, the world knows when we say this is the one place you can find life, that is fight. Those are fighting words, right? No, no, no. You can find life in all different ways. It's okay if you want to find life there, but you can't tell me that it's the one place you find life. Does this make sense? Mm-hmm. Okay, that's what we're dealing with then here in Nehemiah. The problem is we kind of go along with that. Mm-hmm. And what we do is we decide, yeah, let's not rock any boats. Let's just close in. Let's just be places where we're like our own little club, right? And so we begin to have little places that's just, I mean, this is why we had a proliferate. And I always think this is funny. We started calling lots of things, if it's Christian. Well, this is a Christian store, and this is a Christian t-shirt. And this, and we have these places where, those are walls, right? Without gates.
Christian businesses.
Christian businesses. Mm-hmm. All of, we have this, and we say, well, if we pull in, and it's just about us, then no one will bother us. No one will say, you're trying to take over our territory. It's safe for us in a way that's not supposed to be safe, right? There are no gates. So we allow that intimidation to happen. But what happens is I misrepresent God's presence. I do exactly what I did with this. I cut off what he says that it's available to all. I cut off the gates. Sometimes I don't want to have the walls. I want to say, anything goes. It's fine. I can live in the culture just like the culture. And I'm no different, right? Everyone says, well, they don't look any different. So they're not a threat, so no big deal. So I can very easily live. And yet, Jerusalem was supposed to look very different than any place else. It was supposed to be distinctively different, that this is a place where you can actually flourish. And you don't have to strive to make yourself known. And you don't have to strive to get an identity. Because here, you are who you've been made to be. And that's actually what God's laws were about. Here's an interesting thing about God's laws. When we talk about the walls, some of it is talking about the laws. God's laws were laws of responsibility. In other words, all of his laws were, you are responsible to make sure that the other person is okay. So his laws say, do not commit adultery, so that that husband and wife can be
flourish.
God's laws are all laws of responsibility for the other person. Guys, that's really unusual. Our laws, the laws of the world, are based on rights, not responsibilities. What's my right? The law is to protect me, making sure I get what I want. God's laws are laws of responsibility. I'm going to make sure you get what you need to flourish. And if you getting what you need to flourish, if you being okay somehow encroaches on my being okay, then I give up my okay. That's what God's laws are. So that's very different. And that really goes against what the world is actually offering in there. So that's why God's walls, these walls, are so important, as are the gates, this grace part of it. I can't I cannot misrepresent God. That the laws are these wonderful things. In fact, if I broke my leg and I went to the doctor, would I refuse to have a cast put on it? No, I wouldn't, right? Why not? Why would I not refuse for him to put a cast on it?
Because you know it's going to help it heal.
I know it's going to help it heal, right? If I'm broken, I want to go to somebody to get it fixed. And I'm not embarrassed about wearing a cast around. Are you embarrassed about wearing your cast around? You know that it's the best thing for your arm, for your wrist to heal, right? And you wearing it around in public says, this is good for me. This actually helps restore me. I know I'm broken, and I know I need restoration, and this is the way. And so not only you wearing it says, it's good for me, it also says, I think it would be good if you have a broken arm. And in fact, if you see someone with a broken arm or a broken leg, the first thing you do is say, oh, I know a great place you can go, right? Like, I know a great doctor.
Yeah.
Right? We say that. But that's exactly what it is. We're all broken. There is a great physician. And it's not embarrassing to wear the cast that he says, the restriction that he says that will heal us. So God's laws as restrictions are restorative things. They're casts, right? They're places to bring us into alignment with who we are. So that's another part of changing our mind about the walls that we need to protect God's presence, that God says, these are walls I've given you because they protect and heal you. They bring you to a life, and they are laws of responsibility, not laws about your rights, but you making sure that somebody else is okay. If we're no different than the world, if we have no walls or no gates, then we're useless, right? There's no reason for us. Like, oh, you want to go in that wall? You want to go in that city? You want to go that city? No problem. It doesn't matter which city. God says you are to be a light and salt. You're different. You give flavor that is not anywhere in the world. You give light that is not anywhere in the world. And yet we are still reluctant to build walls and gates around his presence. We are very reluctant to do so. Why are we? Well, I mentioned some of them, right? Fear of what other people think. So my baseball, fear of what those closest to me might think, right? Or might do. And boy, they had reason to fear, because some of them could have done some hard, harsh things. But I think there's also another thing. I think there is are still engulfed lives in transactional ways. Sometimes we think, well, God's presence should be given on a transactional basis, only to people who are righteous, only to people who have to do good things. And we want to make the walls into retribution type of things. We want to make the walls into, you have to do this. You have to put this cast on and it's going to hurt kind of thing. For some reason, still feel like we've done good stuff in order to be in God's presence. So fear, transaction, and shame sometimes, right? We're ashamed. But more often, we shame each other into that. Don't rock the boat. We're okay here. Don't stand out. Don't let people know that we want people to think God is, you know, cool guy. We don't want anybody to think that we're not cool. So a lot of times it has to do with shame, why we are reluctant to build walls. But when it comes time to defend the temple, God's presence, who he really is and what he's offering to everybody, it will mean that we're going to have to stand up to culture at sometimes. We're going to have to say, yes, God actually knows what's best, and he actually is the place where you can get life. He is the place for everybody. And we have to say that. When we're wishy-washy, when we say, well, that's kind of like God. I mean, right away, we've done this. We've cut him off of what he has offered. It's really what Jonah did. So Jonah runs away, right? The last thing he wants to do is actually present God as a merciful God to the Ninevites. So he runs away, and he hides himself within the world. He abandons the city and Jerusalem and God's presence. You know, Isaiah 58 is, I just ran across this doing work for something else, and I read this again and thought, oh my gosh, that's exactly what it is. God says, when you present me as who I am, that's a fasting, another type of fasting. That's a contracting from yourself, saying, I want to give God space to be exactly who he is, and so that when I walk into the world, I'm presenting God more than myself, and I'm presenting who he is. And so that will look like who God is. And God says in Isaiah 58 that what that looks like is, let me read from this is the kind of fasting I want. This is the kind of contraction. This is the kind of space I want you to give me in your life. Free those who are wrongly imprisoned. Lighten the burden of those who work for you. Let the oppressed go free and remove the chains that bind people. That's all naming. Like, you're worthwhile. Share your food with the hungry. Give shelter to the homeless. Give clothes to those who need them. Do not hide from relatives who need your help. Then your salvation will come like the dawn, and your wounds will quickly heal. Your godliness will lead you forward, and the glory of the Lord will protect you from behind. Then when you call, the Lord will answer. Yes, I'm here, he will quickly reply. Remove the heavy yoke of oppression. Stop pointing your finger and spreading vicious rumors, which is what they were doing, right? You're not doing your work. You're not doing your work. This is why the temple's falling down. And this is, I hope that you're getting this. This is what we're doing in our churches today, right? We point the fingers and say, well, they don't do this. Why is the church this way? Why is the church this way? And as someone who has a prophecy gift, that's part of my calling, is to call out where the church is not protecting God's presence. But as someone who has that gift, I have to be very careful that I'm not just pointing fingers, but I do what Nehemiah does, that I actually go and work toward this and toward doing this. I want to get toward the end. So he says, feed the hungry and help those in trouble. Then your light will shine out from the darkness, and the darkness will be as bright as noon, giving the space. The Lord will continually guide you, giving you water when you are dry, restoring your strength. The walls are your strength. And you will be like a well-watered garden. This is a very special verse for me. Like an ever-flowing spring. And some of you will rebuild the deserted ruins of your cities. Then you will be known as a rebuilder of walls and a restorer of homes. That's Isaiah prophesied this before all of this happened. And so they go back to this and say, oh, this is the way that we actually protect the integrity of God's presence. We go out into the world. Rebecca.
Earlier in that passage, doesn't it say, oh, thou afflicted, tossed with tempest and not comforted, behold, I will lay thy stones with fair colors in
yes.
your gates.
Yes. Yes. Right. This beauty of this wall building, this keeping the integrity of who I am is a delight. You will become a delight when you do that. And you will be the rebuilder of walls that protect my presence. So that we don't just point fingers. We actually say, what's the church doing? The church isn't doing a great job here of protecting his presence. What are we going to do about it? Yeah. And this is where we come into Nehemiah. What do we do when we see that the church, then we see the body of Christ, God's image bearers, are not keeping intact God's integrity, the integrity of his presence? What do we do when we face the reproach in the church? Would you say that that is a truth today, that the church in some ways is not upholding God's presence? Yes, absolutely, and probably always has. But in our time, we need to say, what are we supposed to do about that? Are we supposed to call it out and stand back and separate and go, they're not doing that? And Nehemiah says, no, guys, that's not what we do. And so we look, what does Nehemiah do about that? The first thing he does when we get to 4 is that he mourns, but it's a little bit different than Ezra. Ezra mourned about their inner life having impediments to God's presence. Nehemiah is mourning about them not protecting the integrity of who God is. But his mourning is actually one of empathy. And really, Nehemiah has this soft place, like, I'm so sad that they're not protecting God's integrity. They, as the incarnate image of God, need to be restored. They see that they're all walking around with broken legs. And they're not going, boy, were you stupid. I don't know what you should do, but you should get back together. He goes, wait, they need to all be have casts put on, and I'm going to help, and I'm going to actually be part of this. And once again, we notice in Nehemiah, we notice this in Ezra. If you looked at Daniel, you'll notice that he includes himself in this. Wait, this is this. I'm part of this body. We're all broken here. So he comes to them with care rather than criticism. And he will point out what's wrong, but he first comes with this care of we need to restore the image of God. We need to make sure that God is being presented in all his fullness. So there is a withness for Nehemiah rather than a separation. He doesn't go, you guys better get your act together. He comes to them and says, we are broken. Let's make sure that we build walls and gates. So it's important when we notice that the church is not holding up the integrity of God's presence, that we have empathy for the church, that we have empathy for one another. Because without that, we will put the church on defensive, right? And they will start protecting the way they're doing, protecting the way that they're not holding up the integrity. But then we have Nehemiah, and we see this the whole through chapter 1 is his very dependence on God. And it is such an intimate dependence on God. He makes more space because he says he mourns and fasts for how long?
4 months.
4 months. Now, did he fast for four, not eat for 4 months? No. But throughout the 4 months, he is mourning and fasting, so that he's making more and more space for God to give him the strength, to give him the direction, knowing that it is only God who is going to be able to make them whole. Recognizing that God is sovereign, that he has the ability to say what's best and to give direction, that he is faithful, that he's not been unfaithful to them, that even when he sent them to exile, that was his faithfulness. And all the good that came out of the exile, because he was faithful, and he continues to be faithful. Recognizing that his grace and mercy has continued to carry them and continued to bring them to. Did they did the Jews get brought back to Judah because in Babylon, they just became an absolutely submissive, humble people. Mm-hmm. No. He brought them back because of his grace and mercy. His grace and mercy is not transactional. Mm-hmm. It's not grace if it is. So Nehemiah recognizes this first and foremost. Boy, it's all God. It's got to be God. I've got to depend on him. He knows what's best. He knows what's going to go, what needs to happen to get walls and gates built up. He then also recognizes his own and his people's inability to fill themselves with holiness. So, interesting language
holiness
that Nehemiah...
Wholeness? Did you say holiness?
They're the same thing. Holiness and wholeness, same thing. And sometimes we think about holiness as something other. Holiness is to be who we were made to be, to whole. When Nehemiah says, God, I am your servant, this is really important because who is Nehemiah? What's his role?
He's
the cupbearer of the king. Okay, a couple things about the cupbearer of the king. If you watch any, you know, medieval stuff, you know what the cupbearer does, right?
Yeah.
What does he do?
He drinks the wine, tests for poison.
Right, so he always drinks the wine, tests for poison, which means he is always at the king's side, always. And what that evolved into is that's not his only role. He actually is a part of the king's cabinet. He's actually his most loyal advisor. So the king's cupbearer is an advisor. He is a cabinet member. And he's actually, sometimes, he's actually pretty much second in command. And we see this in some other places. We see this with Daniel, right? We see this in other places. So when you see that he's the cupbearer, understand, oh, he's got like a really high position. He is Secretary of State. So he gives a lot of advice. When he, though, continues, and if you notice, if you did your observation worksheet and you noticed keywords, one of the keywords you should have come up with really big time was servant. He says, I am the king's cupbearer, but then he keeps saying, but I am God's servant, I'm God's servant, I'm God's servant, I'm God's servant. And then he says, and Jews are God's servant. We are servant. We are servant. Now, what you need to understand when you see that word servant there, he's not talking about a peon that the king never sees or never knows. The word servant here, because of who Nehemiah is, Nehemiah as cupbearer would have been called the king's servant. And he would have had his own signet ring. He's a powerful cabinet member, but they're called servants because it's all about the king's purpose. So when he says we're servants of God, he's not saying we're peons. He's saying we're in God's cabinet. We're actually helping him work. We're joining him in his work. We're holding up his work, just like a cupbearer does for the king. So that should put a little bit of twist on it. It's not we're lowly. It's, no, we're in God's cabinet. We're serving his purposes. So he keeps saying that. We got to remember who we are. We're servants of God. We're in God's cabinet. Our job is to be joining him in restoring, and so we're going to hold up the integrity of his presence. Mm-hmm. So recognizing our faithlessness in that job, and he lets us stay in the job, which is really important when Nehemiah actually comes to the king. He knows he could lose his job if he has a sad face. We'll talk about that in a minute. Why? He knows he could lose his job, but in God's grace, God says, yeah, you're not going to lose your job. Let's try it again. You start working with me again to restore the kingdom, to restore people's images. I'm not going to let you go. So our faithlessness, but his faithfulness. And notice Nehemiah keeps on saying, he always says first mine and then ours. He makes sure that he knows that he's just as faithless as everybody else, and that he's part of them. Last night in class, there have been a couple things that have happened on the Wheaton campus that haven't been great. They've been in the news. And I love my professor. To start class, he prayed, and he prayed about those things. But instead of saying, you know, forgive those people who did that, you know, make sure that they have grace, which would have been nice, he kept saying, forgive us for our sins here. And he kept saying our, and I'm just thinking, wow, that's that's exactly what Nehemiah does. No, this is all of us. We've all been faithless. We've all done these things. I loved hearing that. I haven't heard that a lot. But it was just an extemporaneous prayer that just, that's how he felt. Recognizing also that the invitation to return is issued to me, but to all of us as well. And we are one. So, in depending on God, remember his ability to make me whole, my inability to make ourselves whole, and our hope in him, reaffirming that he's got the power to do it. And he's promised that he's doing everything he's doing is for our restoration. I've got to remember that over and over again. And remember that I'm a cabinet member, that I'm actually a part of that restoration process, that my responsibility is to see that other people are being restored. That's part of my job. And then to request compassion from him. So when I see that the church is in reproach, that they are not holding up the integrity of God's presence, I need to first have empathy for the church. I need to depend on God completely. He can fix this. I can't. Have compassion. But the third thing is I need to have a commitment to God's purpose. If I'm a cabinet member, it's part of my job to be restoring. And I need to have a commitment to use what he's given me to help restore the integrity of his presence and to help restore the body that is about building the walls and gates, creating a good space for other people to flourish. So what Nehemiah does is he goes to the king. So after four months of mourning and fasting, of putting himself absolutely on God's mercy and depending on him, he watches then. From that time on, he watches. Where's God going to give me an opportunity to use my gifts to restore the body, the Jews who need to go back and build that? Where's he going to use me? Where's he going to use me? I'm going to watch it because I've been asking him and I'm depending on him. Now I'm going to wait for him to bring me the opportunity. Notice he doesn't enter the king with that request. Notice he waits until the king asks him. He waits till God brings him that. But he doesn't wait passively. Remember, for the 4 months, this is his focus. I want to use what you've given me to help restore the walls and the gates. How do you want to do it, God? Give me the opportunity. Show me the opportunity. And he watches and is on the lookout for it because he knows that God is going to answer that. He's going to give him an opportunity to act, an opportunity to use the strengths that he's been given. So he waits for 4 months. He doesn't force it. He doesn't try to manipulate situations or manipulate people. He actually waits until God brings it to him. And it happens to bring to him. So let's talk about this situation where Nehemiah comes before the king. And the king says, Nehemiah, what's the sad face? Now, I wish they wouldn't have translated sad, because the word actually is, I think it's ra again. It's evil. It's, why do you have this face that looks like you are ready to commit treason? So it's not, oh, you don't feel good. It's, no, you look like something's going on in your heart. And he says, this is just sadness. This is just evil in your heart. That's what the king is saying there. So don't look at the king going, oh, the king is so concerned about him. No, the king is like, wait, you're my cupbearer, and you're looking like there's evil in your heart. Now do you understand why Nehemiah is scared? Mm-hmm. Yeah. He's his closest advisor, and all of a sudden the king thinks, you want to commit treason. There's something in your heart here. So this is why Nehemiah is afraid. This is actually why sometimes we're afraid to build up God's presence, because we are afraid of what that could do. Now, physically in America, and we're not afraid physically, right? But we are afraid of our reputation. We are afraid that people could misquote us or start saying things. I mean, and you see this all the time, right? Right, exactly. So that's the type of fear, is the power that they have. We shouldn't negate the fact that although God is all powerful, He has given power to the world, and there's a lot of power in culture. There's a lot of power. So we understand the fear that we can have. So, and remember, Nehemiah is very empathetic because he gets it. He's afraid too to go before the king. But he's been praying, he's depending on God, and he's like, I'm going to just say it. Now, the other reason he's afraid, not just because of what Artaxerxes is thinking might be going on, but he also knows what Artaxerxes has already done. Remember back when the wall was wanting to be built and they were starting to build, the opponents came, they wrote a letter to Artaxerxes, and Artaxerxes said, stop that. You're right, they're a rebellious city, always have been, don't let them build the walls. So this is the same king who said that. Now in the meantime, Ezra has gotten his favor. So there has been softening to Artaxerxes, but hey, you're saying, you're going against the decree. Remember, the decrees of the kings are huge things, right? Luckily, in the decree, when he said to stop the wall, he said, until I say not. But.
So this is 14 years later, or this is like 50 years later?
From what?
I'm confused. From the time that the first decree, because I didn't think it was the same king. I'm so
yeah.
So the temple is built now.
Yeah, so this is the temple. So this is about the wall. So this was probably in the very beginning of Artaxerxes' reign. Uh-huh. So this,
when he stopped.
Uh-huh. So right now we're in the 20th year of Artaxerxes' reign. Okay, so we don't know exactly when. It could have been 20 years ago. Uh-huh. It could have been 15 years ago. It could have been 7 years ago. But it couldn't have been 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Four or something. I don't know.
Somewhere, we don't know how long, but we know it's no longer than 20.
Okay.
Most likely somewhere in around 10.
Okay. Oh, no, I meant when it stopped. Was it somewhere around the fourth year of his reign, so that would be about 16 years.
Yeah. So, but we know that he's already decreed that, right?
Okay, yeah.
So that's the other reason he's afraid. He's already said to stop the wall, and now I'm going to go and ask him, can I build it? So he's afraid, and he's going to go in there. But he's got this commitment. No, God's presence must be upheld. And his presence must be upheld as the place where you can find life and the only place you can find life. And that is more important to me than anything else. So Nehemiah does go in fear, and yet he is committed to God's purposes. And he's committed to being in the cabinet of God, which I love the fact that Nehemiah knows what that means. Because he knows what it means to be in the cabinet of the king, but he is transferring that. I am really in the cabinet of God. And it's my job to make sure that God's presence is upheld. So he's ready for this, right? He's watching, and he knows that God is going to give him direction. He's just watching. He doesn't know what it's going to look like. And he doesn't even ask, God, make it look like this, whatever it is. It comes. The king asks him. And so he's just honest. Well, king, this is why I'm sad. I know it looks like evil, but I feel this inferiorness of what's happening here, and I feel it to my depths. Can I go back and build the wall? He goes and asks. But before he answers, don't you love the fact that right in Nehemiah 2, the king says, oh, so you're sad. Okay, so what do you want? And Nehemiah doesn't answer right away. What does he do?
Praise.
He prays. Have you been in situations where somebody asks you and you're like, I got to ask God first? Most likely you just pray right there, right? There are many times that I'm in the middle of teaching that all of a sudden I'm like, I don't know what to say here, God. And I'm just like, God, you bring that dependence on him. And Nehemiah does this over and over again. He's asked me what I want. I think I know what I want, but man, I need to make space for God. So he pulls himself back. What do you want me to ask God? And so he does go ahead and asks him. And probably asks him there for courage. And asks him then that he could rebuild the wall and guidance. One of the other things we need to understand when we are committed to God's purpose. We watch. We respond to the opportunities when he brings them. We watch for the opportunities. We respond to the opportunities. But we respond with integrity. And we watch with integrity, which means that as we're living, waiting for God to show us the opportunity, how how am I going to help build the wall? How am I going to help the church build up God's presence and the integrity of his presence? How am I going to do that? In the meantime, I'm going to work with integrity. I'm going to live with integrity. I'm going to do whatever I'm doing now with integrity. Because if I'm not doing it with integrity, and an opportunity comes for me to hold up what God, who God is, and I've not been working with integrity, I've been complaining, I've been saying to the authorities they're stupid, then when it comes chance for me, and I say, well, I really want to uphold God's presence and who he is, they're going to like, you haven't been. Why should I think you're going to do that now? Does that make sense? I need to be working with integrity at all the times. I need to always be concerned about God's presence so that when the opportunity comes for me to actually be public about it, to go out and actually do something, that those who are in authority, those who can give me opportunities, will see, oh yeah, that is who they're about. They really do want to uphold God's presence. Also remembering who has put people in authority. It's God, right? God has given the king kingship. He's asked us to be respectful of authority. So Nehemiah says, long live the king. The first thing he's doing is saying, oh, no, 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 I'm not here to dethrone you. I'm not here to disrespect you. I'm not against you. That's the first thing he does. I'm not against you. And I think a lot of times when we come into the issues that we need to feel like a stand up for Christ, the first thing we do is, I'm against you, right? Mm-hmm. Right. And Nehemiah does the opposite. Okay, I'm not against you. In reality, he's really for the king. He wants the king, just like Daniel wanted Nebuchadnezzar, to live into this place of presence. Mm-hmm. I'm not against you. Long live the king. And then twice, if it please the king, this honor and respect toward all people is what Nehemiah bases his sending out with. So that Nehemiah is upholding the integrity of God's presence, even in the face of people who perhaps could care less about holding up the integrity of God's presence. Because that's what upholding of the integrity of God's presence is, right? And then he asks for whatever he needs for God's work. And he's very specific then. And then he feel like he can do that. I'd like wood from the forest so that I can rebuild the gates. I'd like this, and so on. And then he ends with gratitude and gratitude toward God. And this is really helpful for us because a lot of times when we feel like God is calling us to something public, to something, that, some way that we need to bring up God's presence, a lot of times we forget to say, thank you, God, for the opportunity that you made so that I can uphold your presence, the gifts you gave me. When we forget to do that, when we just rush out and say, oh, I know what I'm supposed to do, even if it's been preceded by prayer, if I don't thank God, eventually it'll get to, look what I did. And I'll be striving then to do it and to get it done and to feel like, and then all of a sudden you're racing, like things aren't working out, I don't have enough. Oh, yeah. Now I'm actually trying to build a wall outside of his presence. So gratitude is important that we recognize that. And lastly, then he acts confidently. And I love how he does this because the first thing is he's not surprised that there is opposition. So right away, he goes to Jerusalem. There's opposition, that people don't want to do it. There's opposition at the beginning. There's opposition when they start building the wall. He's not surprised at it. He kind of assumes that. And he's not afraid of it. He's like, look, I know that there's going to be opposition. And hear this. When you have opposition, that people don't want you to uphold it, it doesn't mean stop acting. A lot of times we use that as an excuse, right? Oh, well, it's not working out. It's not easy. There's people that don't like it, so maybe I shouldn't be doing it. Maybe that's God saying I shouldn't do it. If you've done what Nehemiah did and it's been prepared, going to God, being dependent on God, you felt like this is what God said, and you have opposition, no. The opposition is, I don't want God's integrity to be completely upheld because that means that I'll lose something. So opposition is not a sign to stop acting. When he starts building the wall and opposition comes, he doesn't say, oh no. He just looks him straight in the face and goes, look, I'm God's servant. Mm-hmm. You're not going to tell me what to do. I'm God's servant, and I am going to uphold his integrity. So he has this boldness without being belligerent. He's got, no, I'm God's servant, and that's what I'm going to do. I remember I'm working for him. And remembering that opposition is exactly that. Unknowingly, most of the time, they are afraid that whatever you're building with God is going to supplant what they have. And they're right, it is. They just don't know that it's going to be good. But then and I love the picture of him going at night. So for 3 days, he goes there and he goes around the wall of Jerusalem, or the wall of the broken wall of Jerusalem, which is why I have this here. This is actually a wall, piece of the wall of Jerusalem. This is a piece of the Temple Mount wall right there. That is not illegal, actually, to bring home, which is really weird.
That is.
Isn't it weird?
I think if everybody did that.
You would think so, yeah. I don't know if ever. I have a case of rocks from every part of Israel that we visited. I did not pick these up. Bill did secretly from me. I didn't know he did it. So when we're going through the port of Israel, when we're leaving Israel, he said it would, like, and it takes a long time to get out of Israel. A long time. And there are men with guns there. And he said he was panicking the whole time. They're going to find this bag of rocks. And they're going to, you know, I'll be in Israel. But he did that as a surprise for me because he knows I like rocks from different places. And he, when we were in Jerusalem, he ran around the wall every morning. So that was his exercise, ran around the wall. And he actually took this out of the wall and brought it. So that's a piece of that.
Now he's crumbling there.
Yes, that's crumbling, yeah.
Falling down.
But we have Nehemiah doing that, going around the wall. And all I could think about was Bill going around the wall, kind of in the early morning hours, kind of dark. And
how far is it around the wall?
Well, different from the wall he did than the wall Bill did. I'm trying to think of what he said. Maybe 2 miles? Something like that. That's what I'm remembering. This wall that Nehemiah's building is smaller, and it's actually skewed. So the wall, I wish I would have brought the pictures up. The wall now is much bigger, and it goes all the way around like this. Okay. The wall that Nehemiah built goes this way. So it incorporates this, and it goes down farther down the valley here. So it looks more like Illinois, the kind of wall he built. But he goes around it at night, and he does so, and you wonder, he goes around at night, and he only brings one animal. What in the world? What Nehemiah is trying to do is he's assessing quietly. He's not there to make anyone anxious or to bring war. Either side, either his people or the people there. So he's doing it quietly, assessing what needs to happen. And even at some points, he says, my animal couldn't get through. So basically, he gets off of his horse, whatever. Well, he probably was using a mule. He gets off and he walks. So there's pictures of what it kind of looked like. The rubble was so, and if you've been there, you understand, because it's on a mount, and like there's a deep, steep valley that goes down it. So and that's the eastern wall, and that's probably where he had to get off. He was assessing it quietly, so that he wasn't making a big deal, so that he wasn't getting people anxious about it. Either side. And then he's assessed it. He knows what needs to happen. And so then he goes back to his people and he doesn't say, get going. He invites. And he invites by, first of all, and this is where he comes, okay, I'm going to tell you. And he says, we're in a bad situation. Very, very kind of non. These words are really, it sounds, in English, it doesn't sound like it's a big deal. What he's saying is, you are living inferior lives. You are living as if God is not the source of life. He is telling them, this is what you've done. You are living as if God is not the source. You are living inferior. You are living in sin. You have got to think about the situation you're in. It's not good. He's honest about it. But he also says it's us. So let's go and build. Come, let us build. So he doesn't point out the way that they're not holding up God's integrity. He says, we're not holding it up. Let's do this. Let's go build the walls and the gates. He wants to do it with, and he's purposeful. He says the reason we need to do this is so that we are not a reproach, that we are not a disgrace, that we are not skewing what God's presence looks like, so that we can once again present God's presence accurately. And lastly, he does it with personal encouragement. He says, look, this is what God has already done. This is how he has encouraged me and how he has directed me when I prayed and then given me what I needed to do. So you didn't get here early enough and I didn't call you. Would you do me a favor, Donna?
Sure.
Would you tell the story about your campaign and how God, how you wanted it, what you wanted it for, and then how it happened. So for those of you who don't know, Donna's on the school board.
Yeah, that's longer than, I don't know.
Tell me, did God direct you to go into, how did God direct you to go into politics, and then how the campaign worked?
So, about a year before I decided, I would say there were four separate, you know, instances where I really felt God's push and God's call to, specifically to school board. Mm-hmm. And, and it came through people, it came through a message at church, it came, you know, through a pastor speaking about just people, how 80% of the people in Congress, you know, claim to be Christian, but then look at how, you know, this was part of the message that, and I'm sitting there going, and this was maybe the third thing in the process, so it was like, oh my God, like I had already had the dripping of water, you know.
Yes.
And two people who called me specifically to ask me to do it, but like not in the sense of the campaign, because it was, like I said, a year out. Mm-hmm. So that was interesting. And then I remember, you know, the fourth thing was kind of the last kind of, you know, blow, in the sense that I was not real super thrilled about it. I remember sitting with Janice in tears and Sue, because I didn't think I had time for that. Like, it was just, but I so felt God's call. And so then another person, one of the people of the four that, you know, along the way, I talked to her because she had encouraged me. And I talked to her a little bit, and she said, well, you're like the person who is always involved in things. Do you ever think that you're going to have, like, okay, this isn't a great time, so do you ever think that you're going to feel like you have a lot of time for that? And that was kind of what, you know, got me to the point. But then through the campaign, really tried to trust in God, and it was interesting because as you campaign, you hope to earn endorsements from paper, Chamber of Commerce, teachers union, whatever, you know, there's all these endorsements out there. And, you know, basically what that says is like, hey, yeah, we're standing behind this candidate, and hopefully you get more votes with that, and it, you know, kind of helps you a little bit. And along the way, like, you know, like I went to the Chamber of Commerce, and I thought, yeah, they're never going to endorse me. Like, I'm not a small business owner, I'm not involved in the chamber, you know. So I went to network and to share my story, but never had the intention of thinking I was getting that one. But then when it came to some of the other ones, like the
paper.
And
you didn't get that.
No. But when it came to the paper and the union, I was a teacher in that union. So when it came to those, I sort of expected something, and didn't get any of those endorsements, and came to realize, and with the strength of my husband and prayer, and that those were, the endorsements were really not necessarily to go behind the best candidate, but to pick who was going to win, because it's kind of like, oh, like we know, and, as opposed to picking who they feel is the best candidate. So that was kind of the low point when the union said, yeah, we know you were part of our union, but we're not going to endorse you. I was like, what? anyway, that was kind of the low point. And I remember thinking that, oh, well, you know, how, there's no way I'm going to, I mean, I remember calling somebody and saying, okay, well, should I just drop out now? Because how could I possibly win? And that was when I was in my own within my own strength and trying to find strength from with not with God. And so, you know, it was interesting. Norm and I sat down and changed her, you know, through prayer, changed our whole course of what we were doing, and got very active with getting out and actually knocking on doors and making phone calls. And, you know, between the doors and phone calls, I think, you know, God, and it was interesting because I remember the boys getting in the car with me once, and our strategy had changed so much and so focused on God that they got in the car with me and they're like, well, where are we going to go today? Like, they weren't super, you know, excited about wrapping on doors, but they're like, where are we going today? And what time's lunch? And I said, well, I go, you know, we're headed over to, it was over by Prairie Elementary School. And they're like, all right. And, you know, they had the map, and, you know, I remember Kevin going, okay, but where are we going? And I said to him, I don't know. And he goes, what do you mean you don't know? And I go, well, we're going to drive around Prairie and see what God says. And he looked at me like, really? And I go, yeah, really? So that was kind of how much we get to the point where we trusted on every step. It wasn't just little steps, but on every step. And
lo and behold, out of a field of 11,
there were four seats, and I was fourth by like 180 votes.
And she gets in the school board. And one of the things that Donna had told me was one of the reasons she wanted to be on school board is she felt like there needed to be someone to uphold the ones who were not upheld. So the people who live in the apartments, those that they never had a voice on the school board. And she felt that was one of the things God had called her to, which is exactly what we're talking about in Isaiah and in Nehemiah. That's part of the wall and gates that God says, this is who I am. I'm someone who cares about the ones who no one else cares about. I'm someone who does that. And so this is what I mean by when we see that the church is not upholding God's grace and God's responsibility law, we're called to be building that up in different ways, in according to our gifts. And so he calls Donna to this. She depends on him. And really? And here's the thing. I didn't know Donna then.